Good morning. Mary has unintentionally provided me the inspiration of how to begin what I wanted to say today. And we will get there. Heaven knows how, but we will get there. And we know we will. It will be hard, we know, and the road will be muddy and rough, but we'll get there. Heaven knows how, but we'll get there. For the past 2 years, I've been serving on a commission established by our state's legislature called the Coastal Risks and Hazards Commission. The purpose of this group of volunteers is to examine the potential threats from climate change that we'll start seeing here in our state, especially on the coast, and to make recommendations to state agencies and municipalities about what we should be doing to prepare for that. It's a large group of people, broad-based, made up of both experts and non-experts. There are a few legislators, they're representatives from a number of state agencies, and also representatives from each of the 17 communities in New Hampshire that are affected by tides. The members are dedicated, smart, earnest in their concern about these risks and are taking their job very seriously. There are a few climate change skeptics among us, but they've not been able to cloud what the majority see as the coming reality. Even so, as a group, we have approached this issue with great caution. I think that's in part because the implications of the future of the coastal flooding that we will see are so serious. While understanding the effects of climate change are broad-based, the Commission's focus is mostly on flooding. Flooding from sea level rise, flooding from coastal storm surges, flooding from more intense rain events. As Stephanie Marshall said last week, the vast majority of scientific opinion is in agreement that the climate is changing, that we are the cause, and thankfully this question is not really a matter of debate in our group. But scientists don't all agree on all of the details, such as how fast, how high the sea level will be rising, for example. And some of these details really matter. We shouldn't expect a lot of certainty about this. After all, we're talking about predicting a path of an enormously complex global climate system. And so to sort through this commission established an advisory panel made up of highly regarded experts in the fields of climate science and civil engineering and so forth to sort through the growing reams of information and scientific studies. This panel included some top-notch scientists from UNH, including Cameron Wake, who I think will be speaking to us later this spring, as well as Paul Kirshen. He's a person who's been advising Boston on how they should be preparing for this. The state climatologist, other people from federal agencies. It was truly an A-team who all volunteered their time to help us. And from all of that information, that curated science, here are some of the things that we have come to understand. First and most important, the most likely scenario for sea level rise along our coast is that we will see a 3 to 4 feet increase by the end of the century. It could be higher, considerably higher, maybe as much as 6 feet, depending on the rate of melting of the ice sheets in Greenland and West Antarctica. We have also learned that by that time and well before it, many developed areas along our coast will be subject to repeated and sometimes very serious damage from coastal storms costing hundreds of millions of dollars to rebuild or repair. Also by that time, we should expect that the most intense rain events that we experience that cause severe local flooding that we've seen, you know, repeatedly in this state over the past 20 years will likely increase by the estimate is 20%, 20% of that intensity. We have also understood that we were going to have to redesign and rebuild some critical infrastructure in some places to be more resilient to these changing conditions. We have learned that salt marshes, so vital to coastal ecology, which are able to respond to sea level rise through a natural process called accretion, are unlikely to be able to keep up with the rate of sea level rise that is predicted. And as a result, much of the marsh that we know today, that we see today, will be replaced by open water without any of the critical habitat value and productivity they have now. We have learned that we can do many things to adapt to the coming risks and hazards, but can't do much to change at this point to change the path that we're on, at least for the immediate impacts. The cause of these changes is already baked into what we've done. Now you know why I was starting with that. But here's the thing. Almost none of this information comes as new or particularly surprising. We have all been hearing this for years. The EPA has been studying this problem since the early 1980s. I learned about it when I was in college, and I'm no spring chicken. Even the small planning agency I work for prepared a study of what sea level rise would mean to our coast if there were a 3-foot level rise, and that study was prepared in 1991. We have learned these things as a commission. We react to them in sort of a curious way. We hear the information, we absorb it, we discuss it quietly, calmly, no one gets upset. Instead, we worry about whether maybe we're being too alarmist or to what extent people should be shielded from this information before we're sure. And we almost never talk about the cause. Just the source, what are the sources of climate change? Somehow it's easier to talk about the effects instead of the cause. Some say climate change is too controversial for some people. We will lose the consensus of the group. That's the sentiment. And I react that way myself sometimes because we want our group to succeed at least getting people to take the threat seriously and to really seriously start to prepare for what's coming. Yet the approach seems to be that we can't be too negative. Let's steer away from the really hard parts, as if destruction and mayhem are the easy bits. Stepping back a bit, I find the reaction quite fascinating, even while I'm participating in it. And it's not just this commission's reaction. I think it's been our collective reaction. We know what we're doing to cause the problem. We know the consequences. We know what's coming. And we've known all these things for some time. And yet we keep doing what we're doing. It seems that we've suspended our belief instead of our disbelief. One thing has become clear to me. It's easier to talk about how we will respond to the tangible problems that we're causing, to dig into the technical fixes than it is to deal with the root of the problem. And that's where, at least for me, Joanna Macy comes in and the way she thinks about this. To turn her phrase, we are seeing this problem with old eyes and an old mindset, a mindset and a way of seeing the world that she calls the industrial growth society. One where we have to grow and consume and grow again in order to succeed. It makes sense that before we can see with new eyes, before we can achieve the great turning, as she prescribes, we must understand a bit about what's wrong with our vision. That's the first step in knowing how to change so that we can better fit the world that we're now in. And I've thought about this question a lot. It's very puzzling to me. What is it exactly that keeps us from taking actions that we know must be taken? Why exactly are we so bad at responding to the climate change crisis? And more generally than that, why are we unable to see and respond to the consequences of how we treat our planet and its future? There are many ways, I think, of understanding this vision problem. Some of the reasons are technical and tactical. You know, it's a natural outgrowth of our dependence on growth instead of sustainability. It's the way the system works. But some are deeper than that. And there are three that resonate with me, and I wanted to offer them to you as food for thought. The first is how Joanna Macy explains it. And I think Kendra already alluded to this morning. Simply put, we're in denial, and that denial is driven by fear. It's a fear that appears in many shapes and sizes. And I think most of us have probably experienced this. For example, fear of despair. Despair over hopelessness or our inability to change things. Fear of causing distress. This is what the commission feels, I think, sometimes. It's a hard story to hear, and it's natural to want to shield people from that, especially people we love and the people whose future we care about. Fear of our own ignorance. Can we really speak this truth to power? Or will we embarrass ourselves because we really don't know enough? A fear of our own guilt. It's not like someone else caused this problem and that we're the righteous ones riding in to save the day. We caused the problem. And especially as Americans, there's really no getting around that. Fear of powerlessness. The problem and its impacts are so big that actions we take can be seen as little more than symbolic. The net effect of these fears is a kind of paralysis. The problem is too big, the solutions are too difficult, the task is too hard, and we really don't know where to begin in a way that would make a difference. I imagine it's sort of like a big overload, and we trip like a circuit, and so we're stuck. I think these fears prevent us from fully taking in the problem. We're a little bit numb. We acknowledge the issue, like I'm doing now, and we may understand it on an intellectual basis, but don't really feel it and haven't experienced the sorrow in the process that Joanna Macy describes. A second way of understanding this is through an old concept of economics called the tragedy of the common. And I imagine that many of you are at least a little familiar with this. At its root, it says, a little pessimistically, that we just don't have the right wiring or the right DNA in our brain or brains that are very good at denying ourselves things in the present for the sake of a common good in the future. It's an idea through which many long-standing environmental issues, problems can be understood. The idea was first put forth in the early 1800s by an English economist, and then it was revived in the late 1960s by the American ecologist Garrett Hardin. It's a simple but elegant way of explaining much of our behavior toward our planet, and applies equally well whether we're talking about depleting resources or polluting something. It states that when it comes to sharing a common resource, individuals acting independently and separately and rationally in their own best interest will often behave in ways that are contrary to the interest of the whole group. The original example that gives this concept its name is this. Picture a common pasture shared by farmers in the English countryside. The pasture is shared and a limited resource, which, if not overused, overgrazed, can sustain a certain number of animals, cows or sheep or whatever, indefinitely. From the perspective of the common property, which no one owns, no one controls, a fixed and limited use of that resource results in the best outcome for everyone, forever. But all is not well. Remember the farmer. From the perspective of each individual farmer, they gain much more by adding an additional cow or sheep of theirs to that common than they would lose because of any degradation in the resource. The benefit to the farmer is personal, individual, total, immediate, while the cost is shared, it's incremental, and it's usually put off into the future. There are many, many examples of how this works in that we're probably familiar with: a fishery, a groundwater, even highways, and especially our atmosphere. They get depleted or polluted because the gains accrue to the individual and are paid by the group, and because they accrue to the present and are paid for in the future. Lastly, and to take this straight to the question of why climate change and sea level are so difficult to respond to, I think it's part of the difficulty lies in the nature of the problem itself. It poses a problem that is both hugely consequential, but also uncertain in terms of both degree and timing. And it's easy to act on a threat when there is great certainty that it's going to happen and that there is great certainty that it's going to be consequential, cause great damage. Think of a coastal city preparing for a hurricane 24 hours before it arrives. We're very good at responding in those kinds of situations, even when that response requires great difficulty and sacrifice. It's easy to ignore a problem, likewise, when we're certain about it, but it doesn't have much consequence. The paralysis, the problem, comes when the threat is both uncertain, yet very consequential, very costly to prepare for. And that's climate change. And that's part of why we're stuck. So, where does this leave us, other than depressed? Well, explaining our bad behavior, understanding the source of it, although does not excuse it, it does help us understand where it's coming from. And I think that's a necessary step along the path to learning to see with new eyes. Learning how to adapt to a world where we must learn to live in a sustainable way. At this stage, with climate change looming, it's easy to be pessimistic. And whether we succeed in this learning is a question. Will we succeed before it's too late? Will we figure out how to get past the fear that makes us stuck? Will we figure out how to account for the future when we would rather be secure in our own comforts in the present? How do we find the courage to take hard steps when we are uncertain about them? Will we make that big turn? Well, I'm not pessimistic, and I'm an unabashed optimist about the future of human beings, because it seems to me that once we finally take a problem in, fully take it on board, and become committed to act, we do amazing things with amazing speed. There are lots of examples of this, and I think we tend to forget about them. Take the case of acid rain or ozone depletion, or the success in controlling water pollution. None of them have been totally solved, certainly, but we've made great progress, and they're difficult problems too. As I say, it's easy to lose sight of the gains, the progress. And it proves to me, at least, that for moments, we can truly learn to see with new eyes. We have done it before. Think, too, about how our attitudes have changed. A small example that we know here is how we think about wetlands and salt marshes and how that's changed in just about a generation. We used to think of them as wastelands, better drained in order to make hay or kill mosquitoes. Now we understand that they're the essential underpinnings of our coastal ecosystem, part of the natural system that sustains us. So we can change. We're nothing if not adaptable. I even think that that's the family business of human beings, being adaptable. The way I like to think about this is that we're on a journey. It's by no means a smooth journey. There are fits and starts. There's successes and failures. That journey involves rediscovering how life on this earth, how we can live on this earth in a sustainable way. I think it is true that we once knew how to do that instinctively, such as the Onondaga and some other native people still do. But it is harder now. There are so many more of us to care for. And now that we've opened the Pandora's box of the Industrial Growth Society and are accustomed to all of the comforts therein, our choices become harder. But this is a journey we must take, and it is knowledge we must reacquire if we are to continue to have the blessed privilege of living on this pretty blue planet. We are coming back to it now, back to where we started. Coming back to life, as Joanna Macy says, and perhaps seeing it for the first time. Thank you.